This is your host, Valerie, and I am so excited to be here with you all today and to have my good friend and colleague, Taylor Petrie, with me here again. Hi, Taylor.
Hey, Valerie. Good to be back.
Yes, we are having so much fun talking about his new book, just recently published, Queering Kinship in the Mormon Cosmos. And we are halfway through. And so we've, you know, as per usual, it's a deep dive. And I don't just do book reviews, but I really study and learn. And I use this as an opportunity for me to actually really, really better understand what's going on, not only in this book, but the scholarship that has led to the interest. And we just are really having a fun time better understanding queer theory, how it intersects with Mormonism, and how our own theology and history is a really fun place to better play with the scholarship, but also look at how we in the Mormon zeitgeist have some fun things to look at in terms of queer theory, how our theology is pretty unstable and fluid. Okay, now when I say that, I was actually thinking about this a minute ago, Taylor. When we talk about instability and how the nature of God is unstable, or today we're going to talk about the instability of the nature of Heavenly Mother, that's very unstable. But like, what do you mean by that? I think I know, but I think if we thought about like how people traditionally use the word unstable, that might sound a little bit funny. So let's go ahead and clarify that as we before we jump into Heavenly Mother today.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great place to start. And it's a good question to kind of get our juices flowing on this here. For me, when I say that something is unstable, it means that the traditional ways that we have come to think about it are maybe not so fixed, not so unquestionable as we might assume, that there are, you know, cracks in the foundation there, right? And again, not as a way of deconstructing it, but as a way of reconstructing new possibilities out of that instability. I see instability as a resource for us to think through, to think with new possibilities that are present in that instability, rather than saying, oh, all of those things are foreclosed. We can't think that because the tradition closes off those other options. And so instability is a positive term in my usage.
Something that you're helping me and hopefully us really think about is, to the degree that we see multiple iterations or multiple interpretations of how to define these ineffable figures, these creative, you know, figures, God, the Father, God, the Mother, Jesus Christ, the Holy Spirit, their complexity actually creates openings for new learning, new growth, new interpretation, new understanding. And I think that's as it is supposed to be, because I think, you know, kind of riffing off of how we like to talk about this concept of restoration here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, if we are always endeavoring to come closer and closer to light and truth, we want our theology and our texts to offer us places for deeper inquiry. And for that reason, instability is actually an ally in that kind of a journey. And so that's what we're doing, is we're kind of looking at like, ooh, look at this. We look at this, or we've read this, or it's written in several different ways. We are going to be spending some time today talking about how unstable and sort of ineffable Heavenly Mother is. And I know this is a big one in the Mormon culture, right? Like this concept of like, we acknowledge her, she exists, but there's some anxiety around, what does this mean? Do we talk about her? Why don't we talk about her? Or why have we recently been counseled not to talk about her if she's all that important? And so, as usual, there's so much here that rather than offering you a specific question right now, Taylor, I think I'd prefer to just say, okay, take your concept of queering kinship in the Mormon cosmos and let's plug this idea of a feminine divine or Heavenly Mother in and just see where we go.
Oh, okay. So yeah, rather than starting at 100 miles an hour, let me back up just a little teeny bit about it and talk about the trajectory of the way that Latter-day Saints have talked about and thought about Heavenly Mother over the last few hundred years here. And because I think that a lot of the ways that LDS scholars and LDS feminist theologians have done it has wrong is too strong of a word, but is incomplete, I guess. We'll say that. And I want to start with the idea that Latter-day Saints do have this distinctive teaching that there is a Heavenly Mother. And there is something very powerful about that idea. It is a way of demasculinizing the Godhead, a way of challenging the idea that that patriarchy is, you know, a divine model, because here we potentially have, you know, another deity who is a woman and who's not a man, right? And so I think that there are all of these wonderful resources built in it. And that trend, that tradition, goes back to 19th century Mormon theology, when Latter-day Saints were thinking with some rather avant-garde ideas about goddess traditions. And this is because archaeologists were discovering in the 19th century little figurines of goddesses. And they were like, what are all these goddesses doing here? They're all of these divine little divine women, you know? And a particularly powerful feminist myth emerged during that time period, that primitive societies were matriarchal, and that a goddess tradition was the oldest form of religion, and that the male god and the patriarchal culture that emerges from it are later corruptions of this earlier way of organizing society, a kind of patriarchal revolution that overthrew the original, pure, more pristine form of society. And Latter-day Saints are not copying this directly, but are kind of inspired by the idea of God, of these broader goddess traditions, and are incorporating them into their own thought. These ideas get revived in the 1970s with the new rise of feminism and religious feminism in these years, when Christian and non-Christian women are, again, kind of hearkening back to these goddess traditions as ways of challenging the patriarchy of their culture and the patriarchy of the religious traditions from which they come. And Latter-day Saint feminists do the same thing. They revive our Heavenly Mother tradition in that context as a challenge to patriarchy. So I really want to honor that that tradition and say this is an important intervention in our theology, and one which is, again, a really important resource that we have for complicating the androcentrism, the patriarchy of our religious tradition. And at the same time, I want to acknowledge that there are some problems with that too.
I'm curious about one thing you just said a few minutes ago, Taylor. When you speak of how anciently in the goddess tradition, cultures used to be matriarchal, and then it shifted with the fall of these matriarchal societies and the rise of patriarchy and patriarchal societies where we live now. Now, you use the word myth. I'm genuinely curious, is this myth or is this history? Because we definitely know that patriarchy did emerge and rise. I'm just curious about the concept of, was it matriarchal or was it more sort of an egalitarian sort of thing, and patriarchy rose? Is that question making sense to you?
It does make sense. And what I mean by myth is that in this case, there is no real historical evidence for like ancient matriarchal societies as the universal norm and a patriarchal shift at a particular time. It was a hypothesis that was put forward that doesn't have a lot of historical credibility today, though it still circulates as if it were true by many people. The evidence is, you know, pretty weak for that. Okay. That doesn't mean that they were always patriarchal or that there have never been matriarchal societies. Absolutely, that's the case. But the connection between a sort of female divinity and matriarchal societies has really been weakened. There are a lot of patriarchal societies who have female divinities, you know, so there's no like one-to-one connection. So people have really called into question that particular myth. And I am also skeptical in my own scholarship on Heavenly Mother, that the liberatory potential of simply speaking about Heavenly Mother, worshiping Heavenly Mother, is somehow a solution. I think it has limited value, I guess more limited value than some of its more optimistic adherents might say. And that's maybe one of my criticisms of the way that Heavenly Mother theology is sometimes used.
Okay, so quick follow-up question to your answer, or maybe just a clarification on my part, and then I want you to move to, I have not forgotten that you were saying these are some of like the way this has history has sort of evolved, including Mormon history, and then you were going to talk about some of the weaknesses. So I'm going to get there in just a second, I promise. Follow-up to the last thing is it fair to say, and this is me having I have a working knowledge of ancient history and goddess and things like that, but I would not call myself an expert by any stretch of the imagination, which is why I'm asking this question. We can say, if I'm not mistaken, that there was a disappearance of a worship of the feminine divine, which is kind of why this idea of like these little statues reemerging at least awoke too many people that in the early pre-Christian Judeo or at least Eastern religion, I mean, there was a prevalence of a feminine divine, even if it was maybe matched with a masculine divine, and then the feminine divine worship sort of disappeared. Is that fair to say? Am I close on that, Taylor?
Well, it's absolutely true that once Christianity and later Islam are establishing themselves as global religious empires during those years, the traditional deities of these various ancient cultures get suppressed, okay? Which include, of course, female divinities. It's not clear that female divinities are targeted in any way distinct from the male pagan divinities as well. They all get suppressed, right? As they're replaced by the masculine Christian male and Islamic version iteration of that as well. So yes. And it would be difficult to caricature Roman and Greek culture as believing in a feminine divine that goes away with Christianity. They believed in lots of different kinds of divinities, including female ones, right? And it's not clear that the female ones are targeted in some way distinct from Zeus and Hermes and so on.
Okay, that's very helpful and clarifying. And offline, I need you to give me some book recommendations so I can become more educated in this area. So let's double back and let's just move over to where we had started before I sort of took us off the tracks because I was just dying to ask those questions. And so we were just talking about the evolution of these ideas and the disappearance, or at least where we are historically with not only the feminine divine, but interpretations, ancient and modern, of goddess theory and how Mormon scholarship, feminist scholarship was sort of treating that. And so you were going to kind of walk us through or continue to walk us through that. So please proceed if you would.
Well, just to say that as the sort of Heavenly Mother tradition gets revived in Latter-day Saint thought in the 1970s, it kind of ends up going in a couple of different directions. One that is meant to, again, challenge these patriarchal notions, and one which is meant to reinforce them. And kind of distinguishing and pulling apart these different threads within that tradition and with the use of Heavenly Mother is a complicated task. And so you will have very liberal and very conservative Latter-day Saints both fiercely defending the idea of Heavenly Mother for completely opposite reasons. On the one hand, she becomes the symbol of the quiet housewife who is neither seen nor heard, and reinforcing her patriarchal husband's authority in her absence, right? In her disappearance. And we don't talk about her, we don't think about her, but she's there in order to reassure us all that the masculine patriarchal God also is attracted to women, right? That he's it sort of maintains the illusion of his heterosexuality there. And then at the same time, we have sort of more liberationist versions, which are she is an equal partner, she stands side by side, right? And a push to talk about her more, to pray to her, to include her in the Godhead. And so we have these kind of competing versions of it. And I think that what both the sort of liberal and more conservative versions have often done is leave heterosexuality in place as the unquestioned element here, right? That Heavenly Mother becomes the symbol not just of feminine authority, of female presence, but specifically a heterosexual heaven. This is, I think, the problem that the last 10, 15 years of Mormon feminism has kind of been trying to think through a little bit, is are we, by emphasizing Heavenly Mother so much, accepting heterosexuality as the only option, the only model here. And so a lot of what this chapter is trying to do is kind of think through articulating that problem and thinking through some potential solutions.
So let's spend a minute talking about some of the potential solutions that you come up with. And I'm really intrigued with where you go in this chapter to kind of complicate like a heteronormative heavenly mother, which I see what you're talking about and how, even though I wouldn't consider myself a feminist scholar, I notice this tension, a desire, a passion, if you will, to like reintroduce and to spend more time and energy understanding this idea of Heavenly Mother, but then on the other hand, recognizing that that might actually through the back door be reinforcing a heteronormative heaven, which then of course causes a whole separate problem. So what are you, let's start down the path, if you would, of how are you looking at this in a way that sort of acknowledges and addresses both the desire to be in connection with the feminine divine while also not turning this into something that becomes once again about boundaries and exclusions. So you're like, take this from a kinship perspective, if you would.
Yeah. So I really try to look at the conceptions of motherhood that are operative in Latter-day Saint thought as a way to kind of think through this problem. And I begin by noting that there is really strong disagreement within the tradition about what it means for Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother to be the parents of human spirits. And there is a long-standing debate in the tradition between really kind of two competing ideas. And they will exist side by side all the time, okay? And so you'll see them both like uttered in the same sentence, and you're like, these are contradictory, okay? Let me just lay them out. One is the notion of spirit birth. And it relies on a hyper-literalistic view of divine reproduction, that God has sex with his goddess, and she becomes impregnated with a spiritual embryo, and then 9 months later, I mean, this is literally how like early Mormons are literally talking about it, so I'm not just caricaturing it. This is what they are saying. 9 months later, she gives birth to a spirit baby. Now, this spirit baby, what does it look like? Is it literally a baby? Is she nursing it? Then they just stop talking about it after that.
It's like we can't go
pop out as a fully formed human, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of this particular theory, okay? But so I'm maybe being a little unfair to it. But it's often used to kind of reinforce women's reproductive roles, the value of women and what they bring to LDS theology is that they kind of get incorporated in by only being vessels of their bodies are just vessels to this. So there's been a lot of feminist criticism of this idea, as well as a celebration of like, this is honoring pregnancy and birth and lactation as these divine acts, right? So there's been this kind of competing understanding of it, even if in the premortal realm, how a fully embodied Heavenly Mother is giving birth to spirit babies who are not full, you know, they're of a completely different like hierarchical order from her too.
So you say you're not a big fan of it and you're a man. Just imagine yourself being a female, you know, when that like kind of like settled on me for the first time, like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like eternal life being pregnant over and over again. I mean, in my mind,
billions billions and billions of children, each distinctively reproduced and birthed. And, you know,
it's like, I'm not signing up for that heaven. Tell me what I need to do to not actually be eligible for that. And then, you know, and then my second thought was, of course, like this, of course, is a patriarchal heaven where women are, as you just basically said, we are valuable to the extent that we are accessories to the larger project. And
so I point out that the origins of the spirit birth theory are in 19th century polygamy apologetics.
Sure.
And it becomes, you know, the reason why we have to marry so many women is because that's the most efficient way to create more spirit children to be born on future planets, right? And so it is literally the idea emerges as the most strong form of patriarchal polygamy is being put forward here.
Wow.
And I think we have to see it as the outgrowth and the product of a very patriarchal understanding, despite the sort of feminist recuperations of it, certainly its origins are in that understanding. So we have that one theory. And at the same time, we have another theory, which is actually a scriptural one, right, as opposed to a later invention, which is that God organizes the intelligences and this divine organization of sort of calling the intelligences into being and incorporating them in and adopting them into God's family is the other version of that premortal story that we tell here. And so what does it mean to think of Heavenly Mother perhaps as an adoptive parent here rather than a birth parent? And I point to kinship as a way of thinking about this, not just as a way to kind of disrupt that patriarchal notion of women as embodied vessels for male offspring, but rather to think about what mothering means as not being accurately captured or fully captured by giving birth. It is neither a necessary feature for motherhood nor a sufficient feature for motherhood. If all you ever did was give birth, you know, very few people would qualify you as fully being a mother, right? And so I want us to think about motherhood beyond bioreproduction as a more holistic understanding of the opportunities and possibilities for how we might think of Heavenly Mother, and to kind of confine her to just giving birth is overly reductive one for our definitions of motherhood. So I look to modern scholarship that is thinking about queering motherhood of polymaternal families, lesbian families, adoptive parents, step parents, all of these different ways that we relate to offspring, or we relate to, not offspring again is a biological term, but as we relate to kin as taking on far more capacious understandings of that kinship relationship than simply being reproductive. And in fact, in many people's cases, the non-reproductive kin are kin nevertheless. And so I want to sort of blur that boundary quite a bit. And so thinking both complicating our stories of reproduction and complicating our understanding of what it means to say someone is a mother as providing maybe an even more expansive understanding of who Heavenly Mother can be in that theology.
I think what you're describing, and as I'm capturing more and more closely this concept of what queering means, meaning expanding categories, challenging existing meaning frames and structures, like it brings up in me this, you know, deepening realization that not only do we create God in our own image, but we also create heaven in the image of earth. We create sexuality and gender in the next life in the image of the constraints of the here and now, or belief systems, or binary ideas about what gender is, sexuality, family, relationship. And the thing that I'm thinking is, you know, don't get too big headed over this, Taylor, but I'm going to just go ahead and say it, brilliant about this concept of kinship, is that it's a word that can be used to help us make meaning of where we can move when we remove ourselves from all of these earthly constraints, these binary ideas of what relationship must look like according to all of these, you know, culturally imposed rules, as it were, around family, gender, sexuality, connection. And kinship does such a beautiful job of saying equality and care and love is the thing that bonds people together. And so when one word can sort of capture a very big idea, to me, I'm like, oh, that's something to hold on to. And it doesn't hurt that I already have quite an affinity to kinship from my other studies. And I'm always contemplating, like, were I to get, you know, a tattoo on my ankle, what's it going to be? And I'm like, ooh, kinship is it's up there, right? So thank you for what you're describing in terms of complicating this concept of Heavenly Mother. And I think this is a really, really important part of this queering kinship conversation because, well, for one thing, kind of to sort of harken a little bit back to our last episode, there's something really beautiful about the ambiguity of Heavenly Mother, that it offers us a platform for creatively thinking about bigger ways to think about relationship. And I think that's important. We haven't put our finger on it quite so much as, say, for example, the concept of Heavenly Father in the Judeo-Christian religious, you know, framework, right? So Heavenly Mother is one where we have a lot of play And I think it's really good for us to also be talking about, from this querying perspective, that we need to expand the boundaries around what it means in the hereafter to be a progressing soul. And we have, of course, place constraints on Heavenly Mother that just mirror the constraints of human womanhood. And once again, if we do that, what kind of margins are we creating around what it means to be in this life a female soul? Because there are women who are on the LGBTQ spectrum who will never be, you know, formally mothers. But I think that it's much bigger than that. There are people with fertility issues. There are people who for whatever reason, never move into a pair bond and never end up procreating. And so what you're doing, I think, is not only expanding the Mormon cosmos in the next life, but you're also recognizing that there are so many different ways to interpret more inclusively this concept of who we are as humans, male, female, masculine, feminine, but also by looking at even how we look at God and masculine and feminine potentialities that don't really speak into the specific roles or even the functions of our human bodies. And this is big stuff.
And that's my goal. And so I appreciate that you've seen it so clearly and can articulate it so well, much better than I have been able to. So yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah. So I do have a quick question though, if I may. Speaking of this, now I want to circle back a little bit to something that you were saying a minute ago, because it kind of piqued my interest. So you were talking about sort of these two different, like a very, very conservative and a very, very liberal believer may stand their ground on this this conceptualization of a Heavenly Mother for very, very different reasons. And I hadn't really kind of thought through that until you said it. And I was kind of like, that gave me pause and also kind of made me giggle a little bit, because I was thinking, that's funny that human beings, and this is not just for this concept, but we kind of take these theologies and then we sort of co-opt them and use them to sort of justify whatever our own, you know, theological, you know, understandings are. In other words, we kind of have an agenda, right? So can you speak into, just for a second, why do you think there is such an angst or a prohibition, which might even be a doubling down in the last half decade even, around this concept of Heavenly Mother, being that there is a decent rhetoric or there's some conversation about Heavenly Mother that might actually validate a heterosexual patriarchal norm that I think also is being really heavily pushed right now? What are your thoughts on that, Taylor?
I don't know if I have a grand theory about it, other than that I think that the efforts to suppress discussion about prayer, about Heavenly Mother, tend to be one directional. That is, they tend to be directed at those who are interested in egalitarian versions of Heavenly Mother. Mm. Those who are interested in hierarchical and patriarchal versions of Heavenly Mother don't get the same, the warnings are not directed at them. So I tend to think that a lot of this anxiety is about trying to control what kind of Heavenly Mother is talked about, rather than whether or not she's able to be talked about at all. And that's maybe my cynical take on it.
So let me ask you a follow-up to that. Well, comment and then question after that. So to me, I see, well, and this actually goes back clear into the 90s, if I'm not mistaken, with, I think it was President Hinckley that had something to say, like, wasn't it him who kind of really formally yeah. came down on like the praying to Heavenly Mother? And so to me, that speaks into the egalitarian notion of, yes, we acknowledge her, but the concept of praying to her by default almost enters into this realm of a competitiveness with, which I'm laughing about, because it's like, no, like even in the earthly realm, we can both love our father and our mother, and what loving one does not diminish our love for another. Right. So in some ways this is a little bit, you know, it's unfortunate, right? I guess I'll just say that. But there's that side of it, the praying side of it. But then I also wonder if in terms of, like, again, and I promised you I was going to be practicing, like, in interjecting this word in the spirit of querying this idea around Heavenly Mother, is it possible that there's an insecurity or an angst around our talking about a divine feminine with power and with equality, because in some ways it complicates how we see not only hierarchy itself, but gendered and heterosexual hierarchy. Do you think there's any possible way that this is also sort of correlated, because we are living in this era of what kind of seems to be a retrenchment around issues that really make the church nervous, because I think LGBTQ people are more and more being accepted culturally, at least in the West, as a part of a group that belongs.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that, Taylor?
Yeah, I think that there's simultaneously a retrenchment among church leaders who have legitimate worries about the potentially disruptive elements of Heavenly Mother theology. And at the same time, we have many Latter-day Saints moving in the opposite direction of embracing those possibilities, of embracing the expansive options, you know. I mean, I would say that the kinds of things that many women were getting excommunicated for about Heavenly Mother are taken, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, are taken for granted by many conservative feminists today, and, you know, are, yeah, widely believed in the church, even if, church leaders are not super thrilled about that. And so I think, like, the church is kind of moving in both directions simultaneously, at least among in the grassroots, but relative to the leadership. And it's an acknowledgement that this is a very powerful doctrine, right? And it's one which has all kinds of potentially strange implications here. You know, we've talked about the patriarchal reading of it and the feminist liberation, egalitarian reading of it. And I've introduced a third reading of it, of a queering mother here too, as another alternative, as a way of kind of thinking about this. This is a doctrine which is not easily constrained to one. And so, again, I think that anxiety that you express there is an accurate way of describing the, I don't know, the uncertainty that this introduces in a lot of ways. And again, the way that Latter-day Saints at the grassroots have attempted to utilize it in prayers, in visions, in spiritual experiences of feeling her presence. You know, there are all kinds of ways that Latter-day Saints are talking about Heavenly Mother in these terms that is really disruptive to those patriarchal theories.
You know, what you have me thinking about as I'm listening to you, Taylor, is this actually, to me, brings up perhaps the angst connected to the theology around embodiment. And this has been something that I personally really spend a lot of time thinking about. If we were to kind of go back, I don't know when it was, we've been talking about this for a few hours now, but it feels like maybe the last episode we were talking about this, the idea of the fullness of divinity is this masculine and feminine energy that really can't necessarily perhaps be quantified in one kind of body. And boy, it gets really complicated really fast when you start thinking about that, right? I'm going to read a quote from your book, Taylor, but this is one that really, it gave me pause. And I thought, oh, interesting. So this is, you are quoting Janice Allred, who is one of our great feminist scholars. She says this: having a female God for women to pattern themselves after and a male God for men to emulate encourages rigid gender distinctions and perpetuates gender stereotypes, close quote. So that is interesting, because I know for myself, as a woman, I have felt the loss, the deficit of only having a male to worship. And so for that reason, as I've grown and evolved, of course, I have integrated a relationship with a feminine divine into my own life and my worship. And yet at the same time, I notice in that, like you said, almost accidentally, sometimes we sort of transgress some of our own desires to not create a heteronormative heaven in so doing. And so to that end, I think this is my thought, and I want to hear what you say about this as we kind of close up this episode, Taylor. I wonder if perhaps, being that we are thinking about broadening and expanding the Mormon cosmos, perhaps for me at least, I think about worshiping a female God as one kind of a relationship, kind of a newer relationship for me. coming from my Orthodox, you know, most of my life in Orthodoxy. And then, of course, this ongoing relationship with a male God, which I'm happy to say has always been a tender one. And I feel in some ways very, very grateful that I've always seen myself as very beloved, one of God's favorites, if you will, you know, from my father God. And yet at the same time, as I grow, I wonder if maybe it's okay that I pray to a female and a male idea of God, because that's what I can connect most with as a human being, but that perhaps whatever is on the other side of that is something that I probably cannot understand, that is the essence of love and divinity and masculinity and femininity that I can't know, because I only know what I can know in my earthly form with my female body. But maybe my not trying to impose on heaven the constraints of earth is the very best way I can both worship God in a way that makes sense to me, but also frees heaven up to be much larger than I can understand or know. What are your thoughts on that in terms of making sense of like this heavenly mother idea in terms of the kinship cosmos of Mormonism?
Yeah, I have no advice for how people should worship, and that's beyond my capacity for what to do. But I sense in your description of your anxieties, your worries about this, precisely the problem here that we take our gender categories and we project them into the heavenly realm because that's what we understand, right? And we also have to recognize the insufficiency of those, and not just as a way of accurately understanding what God is or what God can be, but rather that they contain, that our own categories are historically produced and contain their own exclusions, you know? Yeah. And so the idea that there is a male and a female deity is in one way a step towards greater inclusion, and another way of locking out a lot of other people, trans and non-binary, and many gay and lesbian people who don't see themselves reflected there, right? And so, to the extent that we want our theologies to be more inclusive, and again, I don't have any suggestions for how to worship what this looks like in everyday practice. That's going to be up to individuals to kind of work out for themselves. But at least at the theological level, I think recognizing the insufficiency of our own experiences, even progressive versions of those, to be fully finalized, to be fully integrative of all of our values, is at least a starting point for further reflection.
I love that, Taylor. And what I think resonated the most with what you just said there, on behalf of all of us in and around the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I'm thinking gay, straight, cisgender, transgender, whatever, you said to me, Taylor, it's not for me to say or to prescribe whom and how you relate to and are in connection with your higher powers. And I mean, and that in and of itself is such an open, loving, trusting in us as human beings kind of way to be in connection with one another. And I think that is what healthy religion at its best looks like. First of all, it's not putting, you know, a thumb on God and saying, this is who God has to be, and this is how you must worship him. Because what that does do to human beings that live on this beautiful spectrum of, you know, all sorts of ways of being human, it not only demands of them to worship something that may or may not resonate, but by making God exclusively a certain way, people cease to necessarily relate to that version of God, and then they feel unable or less able to be in connection with their own creators. And so to say, first of all, we don't know necessarily what God looks like, but let's play with the ideas inside of our theology and theology at large, and let's notice where there are cracks, opportunities to explore and be creative, to the end that we recognize that in speculative theology, we're trying to find a version of God whom we relate with and where we can find deeper connection. And the more we're able to expand these ideas of God, the more we're able to also recognize that human beings need lots of versions of God to be inclusive of all the versions of us. Those whom we worship need to be something that we can relate to. And so it has to be more of an open field than I think what some of us have been led to believe.
Perfectly stated. Love it.
All right. Anything you want to say as we close this episode up today, Taylor, about queering kinship in the Mormon cosmos as it relates to our Heavenly Mother?
Thank you for thinking through this with me. This is such this is a difficult chapter to write because it challenges a lot of orthodoxies, liberal and conservative ones. And I'm very curious to see how the next generation of thinkers continues to kind of work through these issues. And I appreciate that you see the kind of vision of openness that I'm putting forward here can offer. And I'm very grateful for that.
I think this kind of openness will have the capacity to save spiritual systems, because when someone feels as if they are confined in a box of what is mandated belief, that leaves others out. Spirituality, religion loses its appeal quite quickly. So I want to hold on to and celebrate the best of what religious systems can do by giving people the freedom to become the best versions of themselves in connection with their communities. And so, yeah, I love these conversations too. So thank you so much for your scholarship, Taylor. I can't be more grateful for what I'm learning from you and being in connection with people like you who are striving to help our world and our church system become the best version of itself. So I'm honored to be in your in relationship with you.
Oh, the honor's mine. Thank you so much.
All right, you all, we have one more episode to go, believe it or not. We are going to be taking Taylor's scholarship in queering kinship in the Mormon cosmos, and we are going to run away with all the ways he is looking at the garden narrative, and we will do so in the next episode. So don't miss it. Grateful to have you all here, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.